Iran's foreign minister says there can be an agreement to the Vienna talks if the U.S. makes a political decision and ends its maximum pressure policy. Russia blames Western countries for causing a global food crisis by preventing vessels carrying grain from leaving ports in Ukraine. And China says it has no intention of installing a military base on the strategic Solomon Islands in the South Pacific after they signed a security cooperation agreement in April.
Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says in order for the 2015 deal to be revived, there are certain steps the U.S. needs to take.
The most important issue is that economic sanctions against Iran need to be removed in an effective way. The maximum pressure policy of the Trump era needs to be lifted. We have kept the window of diplomacy open in order to reach a good and lasting deal. We are determined and we are serious about it. And it has always been us, the Iranian side, that has put initiatives on the table. We have intelligence that the Zionist regime has taken the foreign policy of the United States hostage. Mr. Biden should make the decision. Does he really want to waste the time, or does he want to be brave and return to the commitments under the JCPOA?
Amir Abdollahian said that Iran's demands should not be limited to the removal of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps from Washington's list of so-called foreign terrorist organizations. He argued that the IRGC's blacklisting is a side issue magnified by the Israeli lobby. The Iranian minister said imperative to the Islamic Republic is the interest of the Iranian nation. Amir Abdollahian was speaking at the World Economic Forum in Davos. He said that Iran should be able to trade normally with other countries with no impediment. Amir Abdollahian said that Biden's White House is following the lead of the previous administration by imposing sanctions on Iran. Earlier, journalist and political commentator Abbas Aslani joined us. He said the U.S. cannot continue its maximum pressure policy on Iran while, in words, returning to the 2015 nuclear deal.
They want to use the leverage of pressure, sanctions, sabotages against Iran while they claim that they are involved in a diplomatic process. The problem is that the United States wants to keep the maximum pressure policy intact while in words returning to the nuclear deal. And these two things cannot, let's say, happen at the same time. If they want to return to the deal, what Iran argues is that they have to practically return to the JCPOA commitments. They claim that some of the issues raised by Iran are beyond the JCPOA, but let's not forget that many of the sanctions, including the labeling IRGC as a foreign terrorist organization, was done in order to create a wall against any U.S. president to return to the deal. So that's related to the deal, but they want to keep it in place in order to have a leverage of pressure against Tehran in future, to get more compromises in future, and to somehow create some leverages in order not to let the Iran to benefit economically from the JCPOA.
Iran is demanding an official condemnation from the UN over the assassination of a member of its armed forces a few days ago. Colonel Hassan Sayyad Hodayi, a member of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, was shot dead outside of his home in Tehran on Sunday. Iran's UN ambassador has sent a letter to the UN chief Antonio Guterres, urging the world body to denounce the killing as part of its responsibility in the fight against terrorism. Majid Takht-e Ravanchi says that certain regimes are seeking to advance their agendas with the systematic assassination of Iranian citizens and scientists. He says such state-sponsored terrorism is openly challenging the rule of law, and an international silence will only embolden the perpetrators. Based on U.S. media reports, Israel has informed U.S. officials that it was behind the killing. Israel's footsteps have already been traced in a number of attacks on Iranian nuclear sites and the assassination of its scientists. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement hails the victory over Israel in 2000, saying that it was an unprecedented achievement for the resistance. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah was delivering an address marking the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. He said the victory thwarted the regime's project for creating Greater Israel. The Hezbollah leader said that Israel is a barbaric entity that only pretends to be civilized. Nasrallah said that Hezbollah has been fighting to protect Lebanon and its people without having any intention to grab power. The Hezbollah leader added that the resistance movement does not seek permission from anyone to protect the country. He also warned Israel about the continuation of its aggressions against Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nasrallah said any aggression against Al-Aqsa and other sanctities of Muslims will cause an explosion in the region. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th every year. Hezbollah forces drove Israel out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of the regime's occupation.
May 25th marks the 22nd anniversary of Lebanon's liberation from the Israeli occupation, a national holiday seen by many in Lebanon as a true Independence Day. Dr. Nazia Saleh is from a small town on the southern border. The Israeli aggressions began in 1948, but intensified in 1982 when Israel's invasion reached the capital, Beirut.
During the occupation, we were suffering a lot. We cannot go to our villages. Like, I'm from South Lebanon, I couldn't go. I couldn't go to South Lebanon, to my village.
She recalls how in the early hours of the full-scale invasion, news of resistance operations began, and that the liberation would be the outcome, although hard to believe.
People, they didn't believe that. Nobody expected that Israel will withdraw. Israel, through history, when they occupy a land, they don't withdraw. They don't leave it because they are stealer. But what happened in Lebanon, it was a surprise. It was a very, very, very nice surprise. So people, till now, they don't believe what happened. But the answer is the resistance.
Israeli troops began their withdrawal on May 24, 2000. The masses marched to their hometowns and villages, forcing the Israeli collaborators to flee their positions. When the first rumors of an Israeli withdrawal spread, people from all areas rushed to the buffer zone. Many of those people's hometowns had been under occupation for more than 20 years. It was the people's spirit, along with continuous resistance operations, that secured the first ever unconditional withdrawal of the Israeli army since 1948. Former Lebanese detainees in Israeli jails say this liberation is the only national holiday that was truly Lebanese and paid for with so many sacrifices.
This is the only holiday we believe in, and forcing the Israeli enemy to withdraw with no agreement or preconditions is a historic and unprecedented event which we paid a heavy price for. With all the backing that this enemy had from the U.S. and the West, the resistance was capable of achieving this victory.
Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has trust that the future challenge for the resistance group is liberating the Shebaa Farms and Farshuba Hills, which were occupied by Israel in 1967, as well as liberating Lebanon's natural resources, which have become part of bargaining efforts by the U.S. mediators. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Moscow accuses Western countries of preventing vessels carrying grain from leaving ports in Ukraine amid fears of a global food crisis. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov rejected accusations that Russia is to blame for stopping Ukrainian grain deliveries from reaching their destinations. He blamed the blockage on the sanctions imposed on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Peskov urged Western countries to cancel, quote, these illegal actions that are preventing the export of grain. Russia has captured some of Ukraine's biggest seaports, and its navy controls major transport routes in the Black Sea. Sanctions have also made it hard for Russian exporters to access vessels to move commodities to global markets. Russia and Ukraine produce 30% of the global wheat supply. China says it has no intention of installing a military base on the strategic Solomon Islands in the South Pacific. The Chinese foreign minister says the security agreement Beijing sealed last month with a tiny Pacific state was, quote, above board, with honesty and integrity. Wang Yi said the recent pact is not targeted at any third party. He said the agreement helps the Solomon Islands government safeguard stability and long-term security. Wang Yi made the remarks in Honiara, where he is on the first leg of his tour of the Pacific Island states. The minister said China's cooperation with the Pacific Island countries does not target any country and should not be disrupted. The U.S. and its allies, including Australia, accused China of forging military ties in the region and seeking to build a military base on the Solomon Islands. Britain's finance minister says high inflation in the country has caused acute distress to Britons as consumer price inflation has hit a 40-year record high. Speaking to Parliament, Rishi Sunak said the government knows British people are now struggling with high costs of living. The Chancellor said that he expected the Bank of England to take decisive action to get prices back under control. The finance minister admitted that it will take time to curb the inflation. He said surging energy and food prices are not the only contributing factors to the inflation. Sunak said that unemployment also plays a role in that regard. Inflation in the UK hit 9% in April. The Bank of England has forecast the inflation rate will reach double digits by the end of the year. A report into lockdown breaching UK government parties has blamed top officials for what it calls a culture of rule-breaking in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's office. The long-awaited report by senior civil servant Sue Gray is an update on her earlier report months ago that said parties had taken place under the Prime Minister's roof. Said Puruza reports from London.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here. And he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Puruza, London.
Newly inaugurated South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has held a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden May 21st, with the South Korean president standing at attention for the American anthem and holding his hand over his heart. Yoon campaigned on a pledge to move South Korea closer to the U.S. and strengthen the alliance, but the photo with his hand over his heart was too much for many South Koreans. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol promised to move the country closer to the United States, expanding trade and strengthening the military alliance. When Yoon recently hosted a summit with U.S. President Joe Biden, he went so far as to place his hand over his heart during the American national anthem. drawing condemnation from many South Koreans, including activists critical of U.S.-South Korea ties.
I believe it destroyed Koreans' pride. How can the president of one country do such a thing? I think Yoon Suk-yeol is a pro-American toady, and this act showed his unfiltered political inclinations.
Ku San-ha and her group demonstrated against the U.S.-South Korea alliance during Biden's visit.
The essence of the South Korea-U.S. alliance is to subordinate South Korea and give up South Korean interests to protect American hegemony and American interest.
In contrast, outside the U.S. embassy, one-man demonstrator Han Ga-ki says he has received a lot of support over his two-year-long vigil in favor of strong U.S.-South Korea ties.
South Korea, the United States, and Japan have come together to protect and defend liberal democracy. So the South Korea-U.S. alliance is essential. It's a matter of freedom being taken away or keeping your freedom.
South Korea is anything but a free rider when it comes to its alliance relationship with the United States. Seoul pays about $1 billion per year toward the cost of hosting 28,500 U.S. troops here. South Korea also spends billions of dollars on American weapons. In the wake of North Korea's recent missile tests, Yoon wants to see American strategic assets, nuclear-capable bombers and ships, conduct military drills in South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinian authorities, Attorney General has said that the probe that they have done on the assassination of the reporter Shireen Abu Akleh has proven to be that it was she was shot at deliberately by the Israeli soldier, based on the findings that they have come up with. So the PA's AG has turned out its findings, and it says that that was a crime that was committed based on what it has said here. And to add further to that, bullet that killed journalists is, it came out with the details, a 5.56 millimeter round with steel components, and that is something that is used by NATO. So the findings seems to be very detailed, and that's what we have for you on that.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The murder of Palestinians is an ongoing attribute of Israeli regime racism, as are the demolitions, imprisonment, night raids, attacks on Palestinian children, and the many other ways the Zionist regime controls its apartheid policies. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jim Miles, Canadian educator and a regular contributor and columnist. This article is published under the heading Rampant Racism on Shireen, Mass Murder, and White Racism. Stay tuned for more. Words are important. Using the word rampant in the title gives the real image of racism, not some narrow right-wing ethos that surfaces occasionally into violence, but something that is violent or extravagant in action or opinion, errant, aggressive, unchecked, prevailing. All wars and significant amounts of domestic violence throughout the world can be accurately viewed through the perspective of racism. Racism prevails. It is a stubborn human trait, a perseveration of the ability of greedy and powerful people to persuade, somehow convincingly, that there is some other out there who is grammatically correct, but within this context that would imply something other than human. That is, to be reviled and overridden in pursuit of one's own gain. Many recent events have highlighted the obscurity of racism, as have many events of the recent and historical past. In Palestine, a well-known and widely respected journalist and reporter was murdered by an Israeli regime sniper. In the occupied territories, this is not unusual that journalists are targeted, but it is significant in the obvious manner in which it occurred. Marked clearly as press, standing with others clearly marked similarly, Shirin Abu Aghele was killed with a high-precision shot that hit her in the face, between her helmet and flak jacket collar. The Zionist regime came up with the usual excuses, denials, obfuscations, and only after some international blowback to consider an investigation, the likes of which never produce any justice, and which currently, according to Haaretz, the IDF will not undertake. The Canadian government, in its obsequious acceptance of official Israeli regime excuses for its colonial settler society, did not acknowledge the criminality of the attack until the media showed photos of the IDF attacking the funeral cortege for the slain journalist. Nothing unusual there, as Canada's own racism, its own colonial settler past, and ongoing evasion of responsibility as far as restitution is concerned, is alive and well. Canada supports the Zionist regime's racism and is fully involved with U.S. racism, the latter especially in its foreign affairs, as it participates in many different forms of the rampant racism of the U.S. In Buffalo, shortly before the murder of Shirin Abu Aghele, a young white man, apparently well-versed in racist propaganda, killed 10 people in Buffalo, New York. President Biden said there was no harbor for hate-filled domestic terrorism, yet this was only one of dozens of mass shootings in the U.S. annually. With racism being an inbred components of U.S. culture, this particular killing is noted for its total deaths and its specific targeting of black people. Given past performance, to expect any change in U.S. culture, being its gun laws and the ever-present right-wing media outlets soft-selling ideas like the current replacement theory, is an expectation of futility. Denouncing this one incident so vociferously detracts in a way from the overall racist nature of U.S. society and of U.S. military adventurism overseas. The prevailing manner by which the U.S. determines its foreign policy is through military aggression. Overtly, Vietnam, Korea, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan. Covertly, Iran, most of Latin America, many African countries. And politically, NATO expansion, along with its overt military aspects in Yugoslavia, Libya, Afghanistan, and now Ukraine. Recently, this has spilled over into economic aggression through weaponizing of U.S. dollars, the World Bank, the IMF, et al., the Washington Consensus of international financial institutions, and the application of U.S. sanctions. Sanctions have been used frequently before, but never as widespread as they are currently applied. Nor have they had the blowback that the weaponizing of U.S. dollars is currently delivering to the global economy. The U.S. is the major sponsor of Israeli regime military actions, using the Zionist regime as a forward operating base in the West Asia North Africa region. The hate-filled domestic terrorism seen in Buffalo is perfectly acceptable when it happens in the Zionist regime. The murder of Palestinians is an ongoing attribute of the Zionist regime's racism, as are the demolitions, imprisonment, night raids, attacks on children, and the many other ways the fabricated regime of Israel controls its apartheid policies. At this point in history, if ever, the end of racism is not in sight. That is to say that current geopolitical forces, current domestic forces, especially in the U.S. and its allies, have no real interest in curtailing the underlying racism of their policies. More and more frequently, as global financial, climatic, and military actions, or lack thereof, create an ever-increasing population deprived of basic human rights and human conditions of living. The use of racism in its overt forms is likely to increase, supported by the underlying persistence of what happens to be, unfortunately, a very human trait. Yet it is a trait that can be reduced through education and creating an equitable standard of living for all people of the world. The minority that lives in the empires of consumption and greed and the desire for power over others needs to be arrested. However one interprets that word, and a fair distribution of the ethos produce in all its forms needs to be created. Along with that, humanitarian services, including education, healthcare, workers' safety, and fair compensation, need to be made universal as a right. Then, and maybe only then, can racism be tamed and the people of the world can interact culturally with respect for other cultures and in a society created for equitable and sustainable living on a healthy planet.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of RIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani. He's going to talk about the character of Imam As-Sadiq, alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I may be speaking for myself, but I feel like many times you and I, we may have heard bits and pieces about the life of Imam Sadiq. We've heard some of the contributions of Imam Sadiq, but we might not have that clear overall picture of what it is the Imam did and who he was. So now we look a little bit at the life of our Imam. So what we see is that our Imam, he was our Imam for 34 years. During this time, he began his imamate in the time of one of the toughest of the tawaghit, Hisham bin Abdul Malik. He was a law and order taghut. He was terrible, legendary, powerful. But you see, after Hisham is the decline of Bani Umayyah. Remember that Imam Sadiq has been there in the time of Imam Sajjad and also in the time of Imam Baqir. He's seen the blood, sweat, and tears of those imams, the quiet work which would lay the foundations for him to take it as far as he could. So that Imam, now that Bani Umayyah has become weakened, It was time to spread the ulum of Ahlul Bayt, and the Imam did it. Get Islam out there, make people know what true Islam is, remove, cleanse the hearts of people from deviant Islam, prepare the grounds for the coming of the Imam. But he didn't only do that. The other thing that he did was to work on extending, training, and doing tarbiyah of that secret group. Those people who would be ready, because the prediction of the Ahlul Bayt was that the time of Bani Umayyah had come to an end. They had gone too far. There were a lot of factors that came together, that spread of knowledge, the growth of that secret underground organization, the wretchedness of the people, that desire for good, the hatred of Bani Umayyah, the love of the family of the Prophet, all of these things came together that if the believers were able to do their responsibility, we could have seen that qiyam. The plan of the Ahlul Bayt was that around the time of the fall of Bani Umayyah, the Imam was going to lead a military campaign through his Shia. The Shia were going to come from Khorasan, from Iraq, from Morocco, from other places in the world. They would gather in Medina and the Imam would march on Sham and he would take the Taghut down and put up the flag of Rasulullah. That was the initial plan. But brothers and sisters, a test happened. Allah throws curveballs. The Shia have to be ready for those curveballs, those tests. What happened? You see, at the time where the Shia were preparing, there was another group that was also preparing, the Abbasids. The Abbasids were also Bani Hashim. The Abbasids had started their political movement during the time of Hisham, but they took on the military side later. They were moving, and remember, the claims of the Abbasids were also Ar-Ridha min Ali Muhammad. They were calling the people, we're going to go for that person. They wouldn't mention who it's going to be from the family of the Prophet. He needs to lead. And they were successful. And their claims, the people were fooled. They were so tired of oppression. You see, Imam, the latter part of Imam Sadiq's imamate was even more of a test than the first part. The rulers, the tawaghit who were alive in the second part, the first Abbasid Khalifa, those, it were two brothers. One of them was named As-Safah. This blood, don't talk about shedding of blood. And the other one is Mansur Dawaniqi. And these individuals, how cruel they were, how wicked these individuals were. But the test came for the Shia. You see, what happened was we were supposed to do our qiyam, we're supposed to rise. But when the Abbasids came into power, we were all revolutionaries. We kind of knew each other, knew who was effective. They knew the Shia. They knew the tactics of the Shia. I'll give you an example. Some people think of Imam Sadiq as an academic. The University of Imam Sadiq, he was spreading knowledge. He wasn't fighting. No, no, this was jihad, which was ilmi. That's why you see Mansur, he wouldn't let Imam Sadiq teach. It wasn't, oh, he's an academic, he's having debate. No, no, Mansur wouldn't let that. They knew the techniques of the Shia. And now resisting, when they know your techniques and they know who you are, then to be ready is a little difficult. And unfortunately, the Shia were not able to do their responsibility. And you and I have learned a general principle. Whenever you see an imam, it could be Imam Sadiq, it could be Imam Qadhim, it could be another imam, outwardly you don't see victory, it always goes back to the Shia. When they do their responsibility, the imam is victorious on the outside. When they don't, the imam is poisoned, the imam is killed, the imam is martyred. Islam doesn't have that external victory. Now to our lesson, as we prepare for the coming of the Imam. What was the difference between those Shia and the Shia of Imam Khomeini? Imam Khomeini is a student of the Imam. Why was he victorious? What was different? You see, the Shia of Imam Khomeini are the gold standard for us. People like Qasim Soleimani and so many others who were in the time when they were going to prison in the time when they were captured, in the time before the victory, after that, keeping the victory alive, those individuals. So that special man, the contributions of Imam Khomeini were more like the contributions of anbiya than they are ulama. And then after that, those individuals who stood with the imam, who resisted with the imam. I want to give you one story. The leader once was marveling at the character of Imam Khomeini. Marveling. Because you see, he lived during that time. You and I, we've heard a lot of things of Imam Khomeini. The leader experienced him. And he was talking about it. He said, he was talking about one of the victories that had happened. The victory that had happened was a victory which was called the Battle for the Liberation of Khorramshahr. And the leader explained. He said that normally, according to military doctrine, if you want to liberate an area, if you want to attack, you have to have three times the strength, the manpower, the force of the place that you want to get. Those guys are entrenched. They know the terrain. You want to attack, you want to liberate, you have to have three times the ability of the enemy. He said that we weren't even equal. He said, if you looked at our firepower, we weren't half. We weren't a third. And yet, Imam Khomeini gave that command that you must liberate Khorramshahr. He said, he explained something else too. A leader, a wise person, won't give a command if he knows it's not going to be obeyed. A wise leader won't say, well, go over and do this task. And he knows nobody can do it. It's a failure. We look weak. Imam Khomeini believed in the Shia so much he could give that command. We ask Allah to help us to become those Shia of our Imam so that we can be counted on for those heavy tasks.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen. شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمن
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the Limelight.
In the United States, a dizzying week featured Kevin McCarthy, the House Republican leader, caught lying, and another lawmaker, Marjorie Taylor Greene, grilled under oath about her role in the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. The article you're about to hear has been written by the congressional correspondent for the New York Times, Jonathan Weissman. The piece is titled, For Trump's GOP, Crossing Lines Has Few Consequences. There was a time in the United States Capitol when lines mattered, and when they were crossed, the consequences were swift and severe. Speaker Jim Wright, a Democrat, lost his job in 1989 amid charges of corruption and profiteering. Almost a decade later, Speaker Newt Gingrich, a Republican, lost his job after disappointing midterm elections. Newt Gingrich's expected successor, Robert Livingston, then admitted he had violated the public's trust by having an extramarital affair, even as he demanded President Bill Clinton's resignation for having an affair with a White House intern, and bowed out on his own. More recently, in rapid succession, Senator Al Franken of Minnesota and Representative John Conyers of Michigan, both Democrats, were forced to exit Congress amid charges of sexual harassment during the hashtag MeToo era. On the Republican side, Representative Blake Farenthold of Texas, Patrick Meehan of Pennsylvania, and Trent Franks of Arizona were also driven out of office by allegations of sexual impropriety. Yet when the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, was shown to have lied about his response to the deadliest assault on the Capitol in centuries and President Donald Trump's culpability for that attack, there was little expectation that the consequences would be either swift or severe, or that there would be any consequences at all. Dissembling is not a crime, but doing so to conceal a wholesale reversal on a matter as serious as an attack on the citadel of democracy and the possible resignation of a president would once have been considered career-ending for a politician in the United States, particularly one who aspires to the highest position in the House of Representatives. Not so for a Republican in the age of Donald Trump, when Kevin McCarthy's brand of lie was nothing particularly new. Maybe it was just a Thursday, On Friday, another House member, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, said under oath at an administrative law hearing in Atlanta, Georgia, that she could not recall having advocated Donald Trump imposed martial law to stop the transfer of power to Joseph R. Biden Jr., a position that would seem difficult to forget. It's a tragic indictment of the political process these days and the Republican Party of late that truth doesn't matter anymore. Words don't matter. Everybody can be elastic in areas where once viewed as concrete, said Mark Sanford, a former Republican governor of South Carolina who lied to the public about his whereabouts when he was pursuing an extramarital affair in South America and was censured by the State House of Representatives. You cross lines now, and there are no longer any consequences. Mark Sanford's political comeback as a Republican member of the House ended when he crossed the one line that still does matter in his party. He condemned Donald Trump as intolerant and untrustworthy. Donald Trump called him nothing but trouble, and Mark Sanford was defeated in a primary in 2018. It was Donald Trump himself who showed just how few consequences there could be for transgressions that once seemed beyond the pale for the nation's leaders in 2016, when he survived the release of leaked audio in which he boasted of sexually assaulting women, then went on to win the presidency. In the year afterward, he survived two impeachment trials on charges of pressuring Ukraine for his own political gain and of inciting the Capitol riot, and he continues to spread the lie that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Those episodes were vivid proof, if any were needed, that tribalism and party loyalty now outweigh any notion of integrity or even steadfast policy beliefs. But if there were any questions about whether the end of Donald Trump's presidency would begin to restore old mores and guardrails, the past months have put those thoughts to rest. Last month, Representative Madison Cawthorn, Republican of North Carolina, angered fellow Republicans by saying lawmakers he looked up to had invited him to parties involving sex and cocaine. The allegations drew condemnation from Kevin McCarthy, who told Republican lawmakers that Madison Cawthorn had later admitted they were untrue, though the House leader stopped short of punishing him. In Missouri, Eric Greitens, who resigned from the governorship in 2018 amid charges of sexual impropriety. When his ex-wife accused him of domestic violence in a sworn affidavit last month, he pressed on, near the top of the polls, saying she was being manipulated by Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, and Karl Rove, President George W. Bush's former political advisor. The Greitens campaign has received tremendous support from donors and patriots across the country who see the deception and lies peddled by establishment rhinos. All Republicans in name only, said Dylan Johnson, his campaign manager. Since they launched those unfounded attacks in the last few weeks, the campaign has seen an exponential increase in the rate of donations, sign-ups and engagement. Kevin McCarthy's latest travails with the truth are reminiscent of the last time he had the speakership in his grasp and instructive about how Donald Trump has changed the political landscape in America. Representative Charlie Crist of Florida, who was a Republican governor of his state before he became a Democratic congressman, listed that honesty was as important today as it was when Abraham Lincoln was extolled as Honest Abe, and a myth grew up around George Washington, admitting he had chopped down a cherry tree because he could not tell a lie. Charlie Crist of Florida is now seeking the governorship as a Democrat, and he said on Friday that if he won a contested primary, he planned to make honesty central to his campaign to unseat the current governor of Florida, Republican Ron DeSantis. It already is part of this campaign, he said. It needs to be, and it should be. It goes to the core essence of integrity. For Republicans, the ultimate arbiter of lines not to be crossed and the consequences to be paid remains Donald Trump. For now, the former president signaled all is fine with Kevin McCarthy. I think it's all a big compliment, frankly, he told the Wall Street Journal on Friday. If Donald Trump decides the House leader, Kevin McCarthy, must pay for his prevarications or for the truth he tried to hide, the price is still could be high. Take it from the one who knows, Mark Sanford. Mark Sanford says, we live in very strange times in politics. He said that he was hustling to his son's wedding rehearsal dinner. I hope they can self-correct, but I worry that they can't.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Deep insight and firm determination, the most outstanding qualities of Hazrat Hamza. On January 25, 2022, Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, met with the officials of Hazrat Hamza International Conference. This is a part of his speech with the managers of this conference. A personality like Hamza is an unknown personality. He is not well known. The first thing that can be said about that great personality is that he is not truly recognized. Besides, the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, mentioned him as well in a narration in Nur al-Thaqalain, which is based on a narration in Al-Khisal. Of course, I saw this narration in Nur al-Thaqalain. I did not look it up in Khisal. In my opinion, this is an important narration. Imam Baqir alayhi salam, greetings be upon him, quotes the commander of the faithful, greetings be upon him, as saying, I made a covenant with God Almighty and His Messenger, me my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. Of course, it is a long narration and this is only a part of it. Ubaidah ibn Harith, whom no one knows, was one of the three people who fought in the beginning challenge during the Battle of Badr. Later on, he was martyred too. No one knows him. The commander of the faithful mentions him as well. Me, my uncle Hamza, my brother Ja'far, and my cousin Ubaidah. He says that they made a covenant with God upon an order, and we adhere to it for God and his messenger. Greetings be upon him and his household.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
They agreed upon an issue and made a deal. The commander of the faithful, as well as his uncle. Uncle of the Holy Prophet, that is Hamza, was 2 or 4 years older than the Holy Prophet. And he was also the Holy Prophet's foster brother. The commander of the faithful made a covenant with his uncle, his brother, and his cousin over a matter that was naturally jihad until martyrdom. It means that they would continue that path until they were martyred. Afterwards, the commander of the faithful says, "And we fulfilled it for God and his messenger. God's greetings be upon him and his household. But those three overtook me." Those three comrades preceded me in being martyred. I was left behind until God Almighty wanted me. Among the believers are men who have been true to their covenant with God. Of them, some have completed their vow and some still wait. But they have never changed in the least. The commander of the faithful quotes the Holy Quran, chapter 33, verse 23.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.